You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Hello and welcome to CEO Perspectives. My name's Ivan Pollard and I'm the Center Leader of the Marketing and Communications Center at the Conference Board. And I'll be your host for today's episode. Today, we're talking about what it takes to excel as a CEO. And with me is Vikram Malhotra, a senior partner at McKinsey, also served on the board of McKinsey and as the managing partner for McKinsey Americas. And he's also the author, or one of the co-authors, of this excellent book called CEO Excellence. And it's about this book that we're going to talk. So welcome, Vic. And could you tell us a little bit about what prompted you and Scott and Carolyn to write this book?
Of course. And Ivan, I should say thank you to you and the Conference Board for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. So this book was born in concept a little ahead of when COVID hit, but really in earnest in March of 2020, when COVID took hold. Scott and Carolyn lead our practices on CEO counseling and everything related to helping onboard new CEOs into their roles. And I've had a long-standing and long-abiding interest in the whole topic of CEO excellence, leadership excellence, board excellence. And so the three of us came together and had been talking about doing a book, and COVID just gave us that extra impetus, a little bit extra time at home, not traveling as much. So let's get serious and let's do this. And the reason we were excited and interested to do this is that we've seen, and you see out there in the literature, you see a lot of books on leadership. Right? There are many, many books on leadership. There are lots of books about CEOs on their own leadership journey. Recently by the former CEO of Disney, the former CEO of PepsiCo, many, many books about individuals and their leadership journey, but no book that really looked, or no, not much literature that looked holistically across really great CEOs and tried to decipher what is it that they do well? What is it that they do to begin with? And what do they do well? And what differentiates the best from the rest? And that's how we got going on this. We also decided we wanted to gear this book not just in McKinsey, boring McKinsey research, but really in a bunch of interviews with excellent CEOs. So we stepped back, looked at the 3,500 CEOs globally in the last 25 years, looked at people who'd been enrolled for 6 years and had delivered, for the most part, top 20% shareholder performance. That narrowed the 3,500 to 200. We reached out to 75 and 67 of them said, yes, they'd love to be interviewed. And that really is the background leading up to the book and the basis for the book.
Well, that's good. And I could recommend to all of our members and all of the listeners, you should read this book. It's a good read. It has the McKinsey research in there, so facts and figures. It has the stories, but it also has those 67 CEOs. But Vic, is this a book just for CEOs or should other people read it too?
Not at all. At the end of the day, in my mind, this comes down to being a book really about leadership. It's through the unique lens of people who have become CEOs, but they're often talking, as they gave us their anecdotes, their experiences, about many of the lessons that they learned in becoming CEOs, the lessons that they've learned and are sharing around how do you set the direction of the company? How do you align the organization? How do you mobilize through leaders? What's your own personal operating model to be an effective leader? These are all leadership lessons. Yes, they're all in this book talked about in the context of 67 great CEOs, but the lessons are universal and apply from a leadership point of view. The only chapter you might argue with that is relatively unique to CEOs, but even there are lessons for others, are the chapters on the board and engaging with the board, which is a uniquely CEO level thing. But again, as I said, there are some lessons to be learned there. So it's a book on leadership more than anything else.
Yeah, and you can read, you know, Ride of a Lifetime by the Disney CEO and stuff. But this was, I think I agree with you, it was a real collation of the lessons of all and really nicely distilled to the lessons for each of us, whether you want to be a CMO or a CEO or a CCO. It's about leadership. But about the CEO, you talked about, you know, narrowing it down to the ones who have the greatest effect. It surprised me, you know, what effect a good CEO has on a company. Can you put that into the words? You know, how does a good CEO, an excellent CEO, affect the fortunes of a company?
Yeah. You know, we've tried to even put some analytics around it, not just words. So you may quibble with our methodology, but when you actually look at the performance of a company, particularly great companies, some 40% of great performance can be attributed to the leadership provided by the CEO. And it comes down to the tone that they set in terms of the direction of the company, and in particular, how bold are they around the aspiration of the company, the vision of the company. As I often like to say, it comes down to their audacious vision. And often these great CEOs have audacious vision for their company, coupled with great risk management. They spend a disproportionate amount of time on really making sure that that vision gets the focus, gets the integration in the company that's required. They spend a disproportionate amount of time on culture and talent and bringing their team and teams more broadly in the company together. And they spend a disproportionate amount of time increasingly in this world on external stakeholders, because that's such an important constituency in today's world relative to history. So great CEOs, in my view, in our view, in our analysis, would suggest that 40% of all great performance, and indeed 40% of poor performance in a company, can be explained by the CEO and their leadership model. And it does come down to the relative energy spent on direction setting and the boldness, culture, talent, mobilizing through leaders in particular.
So we'll go into those six mindsets, as it says on the front of the book, that encapsulate things like boldness. But let's take a wee step backwards, because one of your main theses in here is that, you know, the role of a CEO is to focus on the things that only they can do. Mm-hmm. So those areas tend to be those six mindsets. Is that right?
Well, yes, at a macro sense, but I would get even more focused on that in a sense. I think one of the things we discovered is that, and many of these great CEOs said this to us, they said, year one was a disaster. No matter how big a job I had had, no matter how all-encompassing and big it was, there were many aspects of being a CEO that, you know, no matter which management guru might have talked about it, or which former CEOs or current CEOs I might have talked about it, it just didn't prepare you for the intensity that it was going to put on your time, right? And like many of them coming out of roles as business unit leaders or CFOs or other functions, they had a penchant towards, let me go manage, let me go sort out the fires, let me quell issues, let me deal with issues. And it takes them a little while to kind of get to this notion of do only what I can do, and let's manage my time and my energy against things where only I'm uniquely qualified, and let's make sure that I have the talent and capability in the organization to do the rest. So what I found with these great CEOs was they spent disproportionate amount of time on the whole topic of direction setting, and in particular around where the capital expenditure and the expense expenditure and the talent was going, right? So disproportionate amount of time spent there. A disproportionate time on shaping the culture, because they're uniquely positioned to send the right messages on culture in the organization. A disproportionate amount of time on talent management at multiple levels within the organization, well beyond their own team. A disproportionate amount of time on their own team and how it worked well. And increasingly, a disproportionate amount of time on external stakeholders. And these were things they could only do, right? What they weren't doing was what I've seen a lot of CEOs do over time, is spend 30, 40, 50% of their time managing in the guts of the company. That doesn't mean they didn't know what was happening in the guts of the company. That didn't not mean they didn't have a nose for where to dive deep when there was an issue, or indeed where to help push a part of the company around an even bolder vision. So they did all of that. But that ended up being 5 or 10% of their time, not 40 or 50% of their time. So focused again on only what I can do as a CEO.
That's good. And I guess your thesis is that, you know, each CEO is uniquely individual, but actually that is a commonality across companies. It's not particular to a given company. Those those issues, you know, culture, team, capital allocation. There's a great story about Mary Barra at GM and how that was the thing that she went after first.
Exactly.
So are they things that determine excellence as opposed to just being good? How do you get to excellence on those dynamics? Because we can all read the book and know what we should do, but what differentiates those who do this remarkably well?
So if I may just take a bit of a step back, one of the things we did was we started out by defining what is it that a CEO does. No rocket science here. We could likely have done this without writing the book. But the book helped reinforce that the CEO does six things. They set the direction of the company. They align the organization to go after that direction. They mobilize through leaders. They engage the board and really get the most out of the board. They manage external stakeholders, and they manage their own personal operating model, how they lead, their effectiveness as a leader. So those are the six things that they do. I would say that the three things that really distinguish those that are truly excellent versus good, is just to use your phrasing there between good and excellent, are the three things that really stand out. Number one, great CEOs tend to do all six of these responsibilities really well all of the time. So Jamie Dimon's been at the Kraft for 17 plus years. He's been doing all six of these things really well all of the time. Mary Barra has been doing it for 6 or 7 years. Again, all six of these things really well all of the time. Marilyn Hewson at Lockheed Martin, another great example. And my co-author likes to equate great CEOs to great decathletes. They may not be the single best person at their sport, but they are really good at all six of these dimensions, much like a decathlete is great at 10 things all of the time. The second thing that differentiates them is they all have audacious vision. I mentioned this earlier, but they all have audacious vision, but they also recognize the importance of integration and their role as the integrator in the organization to realize the audacious vision. And Satya Nadella in his interview put it to us really well. He said, it's ultimately an information asymmetry problem. As the CEO, you see more than anyone else in the organization, no matter how much talent you have, no matter how well organized you are. And you certainly see more than the 8, 10, 12 people on the board that you report to. And therefore, if you're really going to realize your audacious vision, the premium on you as an integrator is very high. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing that I think distinguishes the truly excellent CEOs from the others are these six mindsets that the book's written about, and I'm happy to get into them, obviously. But this notion that against each of these six responsibilities I outlined earlier, there is a mindset that these CEOs have on set the direction, it's a mindset of be bold, or on engaging the board, it's a mindset of help the directors help the business, not keep them at an arm's length and look to manage them, which many, many CEOs do. So you get these mindsets, and we can certainly get into them, and the book's largely about them. But it's these six mindsets that really do kind of separate the great ones in many ways from very good CEOs.
That's excellently put. So, you know, set the direction, align, mobilize, manage your board and your stakeholders, but equally manage yourself. So thank you for that, Vikram. We're going to come back and tackle those six mindsets. But for now, we'll just take a quick break.
As you and your company monitor the volatile and uncertain economy, the award-winning forecast team at the Conference Board predicts a downturn by the end of 2022. Recession will further compound the crises that have recently upended expectations, from a deadly pandemic to a war in Ukraine and the highest inflation in decades. Yet, unprecedented crises also present unforeseen opportunities if you have a trusted, proven navigator by your side. With that in mind, and as the Conference Board has always done, we are providing you with daily, timely, and relevant content that will guide the business community through the economic storm. These trusted insights are being gathered on our website and are available to help your company master the challenges. To find out how you can chart a course for the future which will allow your business to emerge stronger on the other side, visit our free economic hub entitled Navigating the Economic Storm, Your Indispensable Guide Through the Global Recession, located at conference-board.org/topics/recession.
Welcome back, everyone. Vikram Malhotra and I are talking about what it takes to excel as a CEO. And we've discussed the six things that the job of a CEO revolves around. But now we're going to discuss the six mindsets that make somebody excel at that job. So the first three mindsets, Vikram, we talked about boldness and alignment and mobilizing the leaders. Tell us a little about what that means.
So on the first bucket, which is setting the direction of the company, the mindset that emerged from these great CEOs was be bold. And it was very interesting, Ivan, because they very clearly signaled to us that if you inherit a company or a division or a business unit or a function, and it's going fine, if you just go down the path of let's just continue steady as it is, in about 3 or 4 years, it's going to catch up to you. And the message very clearly was, if you're incremental, it'll catch up to you in 1 or 2 years. So you've always got to, even in companies that are healthy and robust, when you take on these leadership roles, you've got to kind of think about what is that audacious vision I want to pursue with the right risk boundaries and risk metrics and controls. But what is the audacious vision I want to pursue? And you see this play out in three ways. The first is on vision. The second is on the strategies that they pursue. And the third is on resource allocation. So on vision, let me give you my favorite story, which is Ajay Banga at MasterCard. Ajay Banga takes on MasterCard. It was about $17 billion in MasterCard in market cap. When he stepped down 8 years later, it was over $300 billion in market cap. So quite a change. One of the things that Ajay observed was everyone in the company was talking about beat Visa, be the best payment company you can be. And yet he looked around and said 85% of all transactions going back to 2011 were in cash. And so he came up with a two-word vision, kill cash, kill cash. You see this time and time again. Herbert Hainer at Adidas comes up with a vision which says, I want to help great athletes perform even better. All right. And that meant I need to change what we do from a product excellence point of view, a customer experience point of view, and the like. So they don't, they boil it down to a few phrases or a couple of pages, but they have a real clear, audacious vision, right? It starts there. They're very bold around product strategies and customer strategies, and they're particularly bold on M&A. They don't do a lot of big bang M&A, but many of them will do M&A to the point where they're acquiring 5% of the company's market cap every year. And they'll do that 5 years in a row, and suddenly the company's 30% different 5 years down the road. But the biggest area that they're really bold on is this whole notion of resource allocation. They're very, very big on put your money where your mouth is, whether it's your capital dollars, your expense dollars, or your talent, put your money where your mouth is. And they own it. They don't default it to the CFO or the business unit leaders. They own resource allocation. So gives you a sense of this mindset of be bold. On aligning the organization, the mindset is one where it goes to treat the soft stuff as the hard stuff. And that really alludes to the fact that they recognize the famous Peter Drucker saying that culture eats strategy for breakfast every day. Is true, right? And so they know this is hard. So they put in the hard yards, they put in the time, they put in the energy to really focus on treating the soft stuff of culture and talent as the hard stuff, put in the time and energy. But the other reason we use that phrase is that they also think about culture and talent no differently than they think about budgets. They actually believe that you can define it, you can role model it personally, you can put metrics around it, you can build capabilities on it, you can incent against it, you can compensate people on it. And so they tend to do that in pretty big ways. So around aligning the organization, they treat the soft stuff as the hard stuff. They also don't try and bite off more than they can chew. So for culture, for example, they will pick on one or two things, and I can give you some stories if you'd like, of things that they can move over time. My favorite story actually comes from Kaz Hirai at Sony, where he wanted to really up the game in terms of product excellence, particularly in electronics and entertainment. And he came up with this cultural norm of kando. Kando, loosely translated from Japanese, is the wow factor. And he really wanted them all to deliver the wow factor. And he defined what that meant in division after division. And for 3 years, he walked around 65 countries saying kando, 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 kando. And eventually the organization moved to that and implemented it and embraced it. So on aligning the organization, they treat the soft stuff as the hard stuff. And then to your third point that you asked about on mobilizing the leaders, there the mindset is very much about solve for the team psychology. And the big message there is very simply this. It is not about building a team of stars. Yes, you want stars, but it is not about building a team of stars. It is about building a star team. You can't have a team of stars that are dysfunctional, don't work well together. You really want a star team that collaborate well, come together well, deliver for the mission and the goals and the vision of the organization. Sorry, I rambled a mouthful there, but let me pause.
Not at all, Vic. That was very good. And on that, there's a great story about Chuck Daly and the Dream Team from 1992 on that last point.
By the way, I would just say that the sports analogies there are enormous, right? Because you've seen, all of us have supported a team at some point, which has had a lot of stars on it, but they just haven't worked well together. And yeah, you do want to make sure that whatever team you put on the ground do collaborate and do work well together. Otherwise, you can create a lot of dysfunctionality.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm English and we have no English cricket stars, but they didn't do badly in the latest cricket test match. But yes, stars. I actually think it's a really good tale in there. I'm not going to give everybody the punchline about Chuck Daly and 1992, but you think, you know, Michael Jordan and Karl Malone and Scottie Pippen, they all get beaten by a college basketball team. So go read what the lesson is there. So that mindset, so boldness, then alignment and mobilizing the team. The other mindsets, one of them you've already said, hey, you know, it may be the only one that's a little, you know, just for a CEO, engaging the board. But talk a little about stakeholder engagement. And then I think it was fascinating that last chapter about the practice of managing oneself as a CEO. So what do those two things look like, Vic?
Yeah. Look, external stakeholders, there are three or four important things we took away. The first is relative to history. If you as a CEO spend 5 to 10% of your time externally, today it feels much more like 25 to 30% of your time, right? Some of it is planned, investor relations, analysts, trade unions, regulators. A lot of it just comes at you. Because employees, starting with employees, are so active on social media, they raise issues for you to deal with, right? Whether it's the death of George Floyd, whether it's war in Ukraine, you know, how are you going to respond to that and respond quickly to that? Of course, you get hit by pandemics, it's another exogenous factor. So increasingly, external stakeholders taking up a lot of time, right? So, you know, we should just accept that. If it's going to take up that much time, though, as a CEO, the mindset therefore has to be, why should I engage externally, right? It comes back to, why do we exist as an organization? What's our purpose? What are we doing? And then based on that, who should I be engaging with, right? Don't just engage for the engagement's sake. There's plenty of opportunity to do that in today's world. But if you're going to spend 20, 25, 30% of your time on this, be disciplined about it. Be disciplined and be thoughtful about it. And then the final interesting thing that I discovered in these interviews was, great CEOs spend a disproportionate amount of time with one external constituency, which at the end of the day may be the most important, which is customers. Satya Nadella, for example, actually shared his calendar with us. And one of the things you learn from him is he spends something like 15% of his time with customers. And he does it in a way that is not about selling to the customers, but it is as much about being the chief learning officer of Microsoft. Let me get real perspectives from the customers to be able to inform how we lead and work with our clients. So great CEOs, we discovered, also spend a lot of time with their customers as part of this external stakeholder piece. So that's a little bit of this mindset on external stakeholders, which is, why do we exist? What's our purpose? And therefore, where should I be spending my time? And then to your point around personal operating model and their personal effectiveness, I think there are three or four key things there. After the initial hiccups in year one, when most of them are still trying to figure it out, great CEOs do become relentless about time management. Some of them may leverage a chief of staff, others may have an office of the CEO, whatever it is, but they get very, very good about managing their time. So that's message number one. Message number two is they are even better at managing their energy. This is a long game. It's not a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's a series of sprints. And you need renewal and you need rejuvenation between sprints. And so they, whether it's vacation time, whether it's exercise, whether it's even time in the middle of the day where you just take a moment to yourself and re-energize, they know that they've got to project great energy. And easy to do in year one or year two, but when you get to year three, four, five, keeping that energy up becomes so critical. The third thing I learned really around this notion of personal leadership was compartmentalize. In the context of any month, week, even day, there is some bad stuff that is going to come in your direction. And if you let it dominate your mindset, the energy you're going to project is not going to be great. So your ability to compartmentalize, to come back to a big issue and deal with it later, the premium on that is high. And then the final thing I would just take away in terms of personal leadership is I was very struck that these incredibly successful CEOs were very humble. They were very authentic. They epitomized what Robert Greenleaf calls a servant leader. All right. They were very much servant leader oriented. Yes, they had vision. Yes, they had foresight. But they realized that the only way they could be effective was working through others, making others successful. And they were very authentic and very humble. And I really appreciated that about their leadership style as well.
That's a great lesson for anybody who's going to lead anything. And in fact, I'd finish with the book is a great lesson for all of us. But let me just go back to these six mindsets. And as you said, you know, nobody's going to be brilliant at all of them, but they're all, an excellent CEO is very good at each of them. But how does a board pick a CEO for a given situation of a company when they've read your book and they know what they're looking for?
Look, I think you've, this is obviously a critically important responsibility for a board. Personally, I think it is very important for a board to understand what the vision of the CEO is in the context of the company, the context of this current situation, the context of history of the company, and the context of where it's going. So I think really getting an understanding of what is the vision of this this next leader, how bold is it? How audacious is it? If you believe everything I've just said about boldness of vision, you want to test that. You want to test that up front. You want to kind of really understand and assess where this next leader would want to take the company over time. None of this happens overnight, but over time. I think you also, particularly given the importance that we discovered through the book of shaping the culture and shaping the talent, that's another thing that I would really probe with a potential CEO candidate is, where is the culture of the company today? Where do you want to shape it? What do you want to preserve? What do you want to change? To me, that's a big deal. And then how are you going to think about talent? Not about talent as it exists today, but talent as talent will be going forward. I mean, one of the big things we heard from these CEOs and one of the things we haven't talked much about is I asked them all an open-ended question. And the question was, what's your single biggest regret? And 9 out of 10 of them said, some version of I didn't move fast enough on talent, right? So if you're a board member and you believe that, how is the new CEO thinking about talent? How are they thinking about talent that's going to be on their new team? How are they thinking about talent more broadly in the organization? So I think the talent equation becomes a big, big piece of it. So those are the things I think as a CEO that I would probe on, as well as what kind of leadership team are you going to put together that's going to work with you? And are we comfortable with some of the names and some of the personalities and some of the people that you're thinking about?
Well, that's brilliant. So Vikram, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Everyone out there is probably an aspiring CEO. Not everybody will make it, but everybody needs to listen to the advice that you've given. So huge thank you, Vic, for taking the time to talk to us. And I couldn't urge everybody strongly enough to go read this book and talk to McKinsey because they know what they're talking about here. So thank you all for listening to this episode of CEO Perspectives. Every week, we'll feature thought leaders who provide insights on the issues of our time. I'm Ivan Pollard, and this series has been brought to you by the Conference Board. And thank you once again to Vic Malhotra from McKinsey for sharing his insights on what makes an excellent CEO. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Conference Board, the indispensable ally that has helped businesses through war, recession, and economic transformation for over 100 years. As recent unexpected economic challenges persist, you can chart a course for the future which will allow your business to emerge stronger on the other side. Just visit our free economic hub entitled Navigating the Economic Storm, Your Indispensable Guide Through the Global Recession, located at www.conference-board.org/topics/recession.